have proper medical care. The other person had to be wrong. Then suddenly the other person left. And the whole weight of many years of wrong relationships fell upon the survivor. The result was cataclysmic. From that time on, the survivor tried in every way possible to make amends. They could not do anything for the one who was gone, but they tried to live a better life in memory and honor of that person who was gone. And they became a very valuable servant of society, making many important contributions to common good and welfare. This was the startling, the critical experience. A man who had been up to his eyebrows in economics, who lived with the Wall Street Journal, and who had a ticker tape machine in his home, had a coronary. While in a state of uncertainty as to whether he was going to survive or not, he did not read the Wall Street Journal. He didn't care. It meant nothing to him. He had no longer any direct relationship with his worldly goods, because it was dawning upon him that he might be departing from them at any moment. He recovered, and when he recovered, he began to read the Wall Street Journal again. But from that time on, he never recognized physical success as the most important thing in the world. His approach to death assisted him to a reorganization of his own internal life. It caused him to realize that the things that were important he had neglected to that which he could not take with him when he went. He became a better husband, a better father, a better friend, and was much more generous and moderate in his attitudes on business matters. So disaster, crisis, conflict of a very difficult nature is often the great awakener. Also, the discovery within self of progressive infirmities have a tendency to change our attitudes. When it becomes obvious that what we have been doing is endangering survival, physical survival, then we have a physical reform, at least a strong incentive to improve the situation. A man goes to his physician, and the physician says to him, you have to change your way of life. You have to give up drinking. You have to be more moderate in all your attitudes, or you won't make it. This individual now has the most powerful incentive in the world to curb his physical attitudes or his appetites. But what does he have in the form of an inducement to change his internal emotional relationships with life? He has exactly the same diagnosis on that level. A very skillful, informed mental therapist will tell him that what of his emotions are destroying him, will tell him how he must change or else physically, emotionally, or mentally break down. He can be given some help and inducement, even temporary medical assistance. But this is not solutional. The solution lies in the individual. The only thing medication can do is to give him a temporary relief to help him to have the time and courage to make the necessary enduring adjustments. So if you find that you are unable to handle the problems of living, and we're going to have a nice example of this and a really almost initiation into the situation next year when we have elections. Now, elections are something that no one really is able to rationalize. They happen. Sometimes more or less equivalent to earthquakes, sometimes equivalent to fires, often similar to pestilences. But they happen. And the average individual has no real ability to equate the values. But next year, more people who did not know that others existed are going to hate them than any before in the last 4 years. We are going to be mad, excited, damaged. We are going to be insulted by one candidate's program. We're going to be exhilarated by another candidate's program, yet the soul inside of us tells it won't make any difference anyway. But we won't accept it. And if we have an edgy disposition, subject to temper fits or anger, we are really going to extrovert these dispositions. We're going to hate people we never heard of before. And we're going to like people who aren't worth anything. We are going to try to decide, finally, by the one estimation, which is the basic fallacy. We're going to try to pick the one who is most likely to be useful to advance our own personal objectives. If we want to have larger wages, we're going to vote for a labor advocate. If we want lower wages, we're going to vote for the more conservative person. Not because he's better or worse, but because of his relationship to our own pattern of living. Now, with all this anger coming along, fed, nourished by world anger and world confusion, individuals are going to subject themselves to what might be termed a political epidemic. The various situations are going to stir people up, are going to make neighbors strangers to each other, and make strangers with nothing in common neighbors, in a sense. We're going to have all kinds of excessive reactions. We are going to feel in ourselves we know what all of these different candidates should be doing. Then we're going to go into a despair because we can't make them do it. It's going to be an time for great emotional distress. It's going to be all kinds of fire and thunder accomplishing nothing. If you have a naturally edgy disposition, you may well work yourself into a bad illness over this type of thing. You may also make remarks you will regret the rest of your life because you do not have the composure to sit down quietly. You do not have the natural inclination to try to study the needs and are going to vote according to the journalists, the columnists, or the television reporters. We are going to find also that party lines become more important than principles, and the individual who is immature in himself is going to have a Roman holiday with his own weaknesses. Now, there's no need for this, and it will save a great deal of wear and tear if we begin to moderate all attitudes. A matter of who is going to run something is really not a matter for riots. It is a matter for very deep, quiet consideration of values. The individual who is constantly parading has not considered the values adequately, or he wouldn't have time to parade. And if he thinks deeply enough, he might have difficulty in finding any cause to parade with. But on the surface, all these things become dramatic. And they also become definitely psychotic. But assuming we live through this with fair chance, we come back again to the individual. Every one of these pressures, personal, collective, are shocks. They are periods of tremendous crisis in the emotional life. So I think it would be very good for the person who has this type of attitude and is always wanting to do something strenuous should begin to rechannel his own resources. You cannot serve two masters at the same time. You cannot serve your own weaknesses at the same time you are performing constructive actions. Therefore, anyone who is too much alone, which often contributes to anger or melancholy, or is too one-pointed in their objectives so that anything that is done not in agreement with them, in agreement with them, becomes an enemy, should find other constructive channels through which they can express their feelings in a happier and more benevolent way. Speaking of the reaction of feelings, however, for many years, Japanese industry has had a very interesting attitude on this subject. In nearly all large industrial organizations, there is room set aside for grievances. In this room, which is sparsely furnished, probably only a chair, hangs one of these punching bags that is used in athletics, one of these dummy type of things which the football player learns to tackle. It is suspended from the ceiling. If you're unhappy, you're mad, you have grievances against the boss, if you think the business is unfair and that you have not been given the promotions you deserve, you go in there, close the door, and punch the bag, who becomes the person you don't like. The boss is the bag. So you punch it and fight it, and you talk about it, and you scream and you shout at it. And while you do it in that room, there is no penalty. There is not held against you. So you get it out of your system and go back to work. This is a quite acute psychological idea that's proved very successful. Now, when you feel some kind of a tension coming into your life that you don't know how to handle, you might enter that little room which the Bible calls the closet. And there you fight it out with yourself. Instead of fighting it out with someone else, you fight it out with the boss who is unfair. And that boss who is unfair is yourself. It is your will, determination to accomplish regardless of cost or consequence. It is ambition, which you're going to justify if it kills you and everybody else. It is revenge, which you live for, and which you cannot endure giving up. It's retaliation, or perhaps it's just the simple case of giving other people a piece of your mind, which is usually a very small piece. So you go into yourself and you settle down quietly and fight it out with yourself. Now, you're going to find when you do that, however, that the battle is not as complicated as it seems. Because in the self in you, the spiritual over-self, is not going to fight. You can batter it around as much as you want to. It simply remains there. It's like the little Zen figure of Daruma, the little weight that no matter how often you tip it over, always bounces back. The adversary does not, in this case, does not retaliate. It lets you fight it out until you gradually come to realize that you are fighting a shadow. That the thing that you're fighting, you cannot win. It is something too deep, too mysterious, too powerful. It is something that, with one slight stroke, can kill you. For if that heart, which is dependent upon life, stops, you're through, regardless of all the controversies you may have. You must leave all your grievances and all your antagonisms behind you, even though you try to perpetuate them in your last will and testament. Actually, when you get in there and work it out with yourself, you punch a few times at your own inner self, and then you get a little tired. And finally, you do what everyone has to do. You give up yourself and get back in line with the truth. It's maybe not a perfect analogy, but it has its points. Actually, inside of yourself, it has to be worked out. And there are all kinds of ways of working it out, all of them requiring one essential value: getting your mind off of yourself. Stop cuddling by using the mind forever to justify your own action. Get your mind working on useful and constructive matters. Instead of regretting the past, build for the future. Instead of damaging the present, improve it. Realizing always that the decision is with you. If you once find it useful, you'll discover also that most people cannot live successfully in solitude. Most people cannot afford to be alone with themselves too long. The ability to be alone with yourself, happy and well-adjusted, is one of the highest levels of philosophical insight, and very few persons have achieved it. To live at peace with yourself means that you must be living in a self that is peaceful. Until that time, when you can really achieve such a dramatic, important change in yourself, it is better to channel the energy which is used for grievances into other channels of activity. It means broaden the horizon, broaden the foundation of your life, increase your interests, find new positive dedications. In this way, relieving stress without damage. The energy behind the temper fit, if properly trained, might make a beautiful painting, or it might compose a great piece of music, or it might go out and help someone who is sick. The energy that used destructively is the cause of karma. The misuse of the divine power to give life adds desperately to the burden of our indebtedness to life. There are many ways, they don't all have to be great altruistic achievements, but they can be constructive. Study, self-improvement, hobbies, avocational interests, travel, or gradually the development of some specialized personal skill. All of these have a tendency to create a new attitude toward life. The book collector who has been searching for 20 years to find a certain volume has been sustained not by the fact that he hated the volume, but that he longed for it. And if at the end of his search he attains it and he secures it, he is happy. Now, this is a very simple way of being happy. You don't have to have quite such a difficult volume to find, but you can be happy by the achievement of some constructive, pleasant, creative, inspiring end that brings with it a tangible and more or less immediate reward. You can dedicate your future, therefore, to an achievement rather than an endurance. You can stop at any moment and turn the energy which you have away from all destructive outlets. After all, the energy with which we knock a man down is also the energy by which we must lift him up. Whatever energy we use has its positive and negative aspects. All negative aspects injure everything involved. All the constructive aspects advance causes of life on many, many different levels. We know a number of older people who have formed groups for various purposes, some of them charitable. Some have gone into hospitalization as helpers. Some have become tutors of children, teachers of music. Some have had the tremendous experience that Anne Sullivan had when she brought Helen Keller out of darkness into light. These were great dedications. And in the case of Helen Keller, it was a very outstanding example, because the completely locked child was almost impossible. Disposition incredible. Locked away from everything, light, darkness, everything. And yet, under the care of a dedicated person, Helen Keller responded and became one of the most dedicated women of her time and a tremendous inspiration to other people. If Anne Sullivan had turned when Helen struck her, knocked her down, screamed at her, turned away with resentment. She might have found a little temporary satisfaction, but she lived to have the greatest satisfaction a person can have, the bringing of life into light. So whenever we create antagonisms, we simply deprive ourselves of something. When we perpetuate these feelings, we perpetuate the impoverishment of ourselves. So everywhere where fear, worry, anxiety, doubt, all these anguish, egotism, overambition, frustration, wherever any of these emotions exist, there is an energy crying out to be used constructively, to be put to work, to do something that makes life better. If you use it that way, someday you will receive the reaction. Something that you have done will become a great consolation to you, a great source of internal realization of achievement in the name of truth. So we have to start by an energy equivalent. Now we have energy equivalents in nature. One of the most problemed ones at the moment is our petroleum industry. We have been gradually exhausting the supply of petroleum in this earth, which is really a bottle made up of a number of contents. Someday we're going to empty the bottle. But in the meantime, we have wasted this product. We have refused to control the use of it. We have placed our own pleasure and our own comfort above the preservation of an essential natural resource. One of these days we're going to be without it. But even this has its answer. For being without it, we are going to be forced to make adjustments. And these adjustments are not going to be pleasant. It would have been much happier for all concerned if we had anticipated the problem and solved it. Now, in the human being, we have energy. Man is the only creature in nature with mind and renewable energy. Other forms of life, like growing plants and so forth, have renewable energy, but not intelligence renewable energy. We have it. And one of the most important things in life is to find out how to use that energy. It is limited, but it is renewable. And during the course of life, this energy principle is handed down from one generation to another to maintain the works of the world. This energy is our greatest natural resource in ourselves. If we continue to waste it, doing exactly as we please and contrary to common sense, we exhaust it in ourselves, and when energy fails, we end. Therefore, the conservation of energy in itself is the greatest possible inducement to the regulation of attitudes. It takes just as much energy to have a temper fit as it would take to perform a great constructive action. We have to use this energy, but if we abuse it and depreciate it and exhaust it, we become lacking in energy, and then all the projects of life become a burden and a responsibility. So we have to conserve the energy while we have it. We have to use it as wisely as we can, and we must dedicate that use to the divine power which provided the energy in the first place. We are living off of the life of God. We are living in the life of God. And this life, which we so superficially use, is really a divine endowment. It is something put in us for our salvation, and too many of us use it for our destruction. All of these things tell us that blessed is peace of mind, quietude, dedication. It is not that the individual shall do nothing. It is not that he should run away from life because it has hurt him. It is not that he should move out of the house because the family is uncongenial. It is that the individual, in his own positive way, makes peace with life. and recognizes the importance of using life in society, not to go off into a hole somewhere and try to get along with yourself, which is usually about as difficult as getting along with other people. Actually, the real answer is to take the energy which was intended for a constructive use and put it to that constructive use. Everywhere there is need, everywhere today people are under stress and strain. Many are comparatively futile as far as solving their problems are concerned. Others live almost daily in tragedy. But in a case like that, no human being can afford to waste life in a temper fit. There is much more to be done. There is an opportunity, and there is always the full realization that our own crises, our own complex situations, are intended to bring us to the realization of our responsibilities. We are not to be muscle-bound trying to control ourselves. We are rather going to express ourselves on a constructive level. We are going to do that which is necessary for our own good and the common good. For if we betray the common good, we will ultimately betray our own. We are going to do what is necessary to perpetuate and maintain the progress of the human purpose. We are here to perfect something and not to abuse it. We are here to realize ultimately the absolute unity of life, that we are not only each other's brothers, we are essentially and primarily one being. Our brother is ourself in another body. The stranger is ourself in another body. Our enemy is ourself in another body. And by gradually coming to this realization, we overcome the divisional factors of illusion within ourselves. It doesn't mean that we all have to go out and agree with everyone we disagree with. Far from it. But we must agree with the truth within ourselves. And if we do this, we cannot have too much conflict with others. Being that if we cannot do something to help a person to be better, then we will quietly retire and let someone else help him. If we are not able to be friendly and companionable, we will bless the stranger, but we will never, in any case, argue or fight with him. If he has to go his way, that is up to him. But we will never add spark to a flame, and we will never stir a fire with a sword. If we recognize these truths, we can quietly, in general, solve most of the dispositional problems of our living. We can become more friendly, and we can become more optimistic. For every time we find something good in life, it adds to our optimism. Whenever we are disillusioned about something else, it contributes to our pessimism. Pessimism is not our way. It is not the way of heaven. The proper way for the individual is through his own gradually unfolding consciousness to see something a little better every day and become increasingly aware of the infinite availability of the good being that which should cause rejoicing to the spirit. While we nurse our weaknesses, there will be no rejoicing. But when we give the best part of ourselves leadership over the rest, then we will live in the light, as it is intended that we should. Man is a wonderful creature, selling himself short. He is capable of magnificence and is satisfied with mediocrity. He is capable of infinite forgiveness, and so he goes on year after year nursing a grudge. All of these are misuses of the human being himself, and nature will not endorse misuse. Nature may be patient, but in the long run, man will do what he was intended to do. And as one wise man said at one time, the difference between a philosopher and a fool is simply this. A fool is forced by universal procedures to accomplish that against his will, which the philosopher already enjoys and has achieved. In other words, the foolish person must do what the wise person glories in doing. Under those conditions, we can make some changes. And now is the appropriate moment, because there is never a time while there is still breath within us that we cannot gradually eliminate a little acidosis from the circulatory system. We can do better. We can sleep better, live better, have a greater optimism and a greater usefulness, and find more and more from within ourselves the reason why we are here in the first place. If this type of thinking is developed a little bit, and the older person especially usually has plenty of time to develop it, if it is developed, strengthened, and put to work, not only will the complainers be less numerous, but many whose complaints have alienated them will find that they are welcomed back into the family of good nature. If this achieves its end, the lonely will no longer be alone, but will be bound together, not by responsibilities, duties, and obligations, but by the very simple and gentle power of love. When we get to be lovable, we're loved. When we're not lovable, we're not loved. But everyone can be lovable. Thank you very much, folks.